the Green Bay Packers and Aaron Rodgers are on the verge of an agreement that will give Aaron Rodgers enough concessions to bring him back to Green Bay for at least one more season. Let me tell you that as of last week, Aaron Rodgers' plan was not to show up to training camp and to not play this season. And the talks intensified over the weekend to the point where they offered, the Packers did, enough in the way of concessions to get Aaron Rodgers to change his stance.
The Green Bay Packers offseason has felt like this weird quiz show full of answers in the form of questions. But now we are on the verge of something kind of like clarity, a temporary resolution between the team and its unparalleled but unhappy quarterback, Aaron Rodgers. So today, as NFL training camps open, Bill Barnwell dissects that deal and the other very delicate dances all around the league. And then Ashley Brewer explains, the legend of the swimmer who is on the verge of becoming the most decorated female Olympian that has ever lived. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Tuesday, July 27th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by UKG. Our purpose is people. Bill Barnwell, welcome back, man. So much has happened since you were last on the pod, but I don't want to bury the lead here. You are now engaged. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. That's true. I realized I'm very lucky to have a partner who tolerates me talking about football at midnight with you 20 weeks a year before she goes to bed.
Bill Barnwell writes a weekly column on ESPN Plus and hosts the Bill Barnwell Show podcast.
But what was really upsetting is that I proposed in early July. I bought a normal engagement ring. And then two weeks later, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers post their Super Bowl rings and they made NFL player hands look tiny. So it's important to time your engagement to not coincide with owners buying Super Bowl rings for people.
Yeah, Bill, that's a good reminder to never get in a ring measuring contest with Tom Brady as a general principle. But while you and Aaron, your fiance, have committed to each other now for the long haul, it sounds like, I do need to ask you today about the other union we're here to discuss, maybe the most complex relationship in the entire NFL, and that is the one between Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers. Because it is Monday evening, Bill, and we just learned, thanks to Adam Schefter, that Rodgers and the Packers have been talking. They have been talking, they're sorting out a plan that should result in him showing up at training camp. After all, this after an offseason that suggested at various points that he would not do that very thing. So what is going on right now in Wisconsin?
Well, first off, I want to thank Aaron Rodgers and the Packers for 4 months of prime offseason content when nothing else was happening in the NFL. I mean, what's funny about this all is that for a team that just lost to Tom Brady, Pablo, the Packers and Aaron Rodgers seem to really be following the playbook Brady laid down during his final season with the Patriots. So just as a reminder, in August of 2019, Brady signed what was announced as a two-year extension. What it really was a cap exercise. Brady got a raise for 2019, and by adding voidable years to the end of the contract, the Patriots were able to reduce Brady's cap hit. That gave them the space they needed to sign Antonio Brown. Now, that did not go all that well for the Patriots, but Brady's new deal was great for Brady. It voided automatically after the 2019 season and prevented the Patriots from using the franchise tag on their legendary quarterback, which freed up Brady to go to the Buccaneers. Now, Rodgers isn't going to have that kind of freedom, but after the negotiations between the organization and Rodgers' camp, each side is getting something they want, just not necessarily as soon as they might want it. Rodgers currently has 3 years left on his contract, but according to Adam Schefter, the Packers are going to void the final year of that deal and remove any right to tag their quarterback with the franchise or transition tag. Rodgers' base salary is going to be converted to a signing bonus. That's going to create some short-term cap space for the Packers this upcoming season. Crucially, though, from Green Bay's side, they're still going to have Rodgers under contract for 2022. So while we've seen reports they're going to review his situation with the organization, What that really means in practice is that they're still going to have the ability to trade Rodgers next spring and get a significant haul of picks in return. At that point, in the spring of 22, it sounds like the Packers will move on to Jordan Love, their 2020 first-round pick, as their starting quarterback, and Rodgers will end up finishing his career somewhere besides Green Bay.
I love, Bill, that we have the possibility here that we're going to, like, do a version of this again next spring. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's not concrete enough for us to just say, oh, yeah, they know exactly what they're going to do. We're going to be spouting takes, thanks to Aaron Rodgers, for a very long time, it feels like.
Absolutely. This is like, it's like knowing there's going to be a lottery in 6 months. It's so wonderful.
I like to think, by the way, that Aaron Rodgers just saw the game film, the All-22 of LeVar Burton hosting Jeopardy, and decided to be like, you know what? I need to stick to what I'm actually good at. Because look, what this means for Green Bay now, with him actually playing football this season, I mean, this kind of feels like a win in the present tense for the Packers. Am I wrong about that?
Oh, absolutely. If the Packers could have had this scenario play out 4 months ago, they would have taken it in a heartbeat. This is a huge win for the organization. The only real meaningful concession Rodgers was able to extract as part of this four-month-long flirtation with becoming a game show host is having the 2023 season voided off of his contract. I guess maybe, according to Trey Wingo, he's encouraged the Packers to trade for former teammate Randall Cobb. Okay, fine. But unless there's something added like a no-trade clause or a void after the 2021 season where Rodgers can help dictate where he plays in 2022, he's still subject to the whims and desires of the Green Bay Packers organization. There's a reason he posted a still of The Last Dance, available on ESPN+, simultaneously yes. on Instagram with Devontae Adams last week.
And we all know The Last Dance ended very undramatically. There was nothing soap opera-like about that conclusion either. But Devontae Adams, man, I do want to get into him here because, yes, they jointly shared JPEGs on Instagram. They did that. But with Adams now in his own feud with the Packers and Rodgers coming back, what do you think this means for everything we've learned via social media about Rodgers and Adams playing together again?
Okay, first, Pablo, now this might speak to my psyche, which is very different from the psyche of a professional athlete, but the first thing I thought about when I saw that Rodgers and Adams had posted the same Last Dance still on their respective Instagram stories is whether their other teammates would feel left out. Now, if you're Alan Lazard or a Marquez Valdez-Scantling, yeah. Do you just add the image a couple hours later just to pretend like you were supposed to be included? Do you say you were sleeping and forgot to post it? Blame your social media guy? Or do
Photoshop.
You go for
yeah, do Photoshop? Photoshop? Yes,
yeah,
something.
Do you throw in an image of Luke Longley or Bill Wennington, a lesser Bulls star? Nobody likes feeling excluded, but this seems to be a Rodgers and Adams situation. Now, on paper, this should be easy. The Packers, even though they have Alan Lazard, even though they have Marquez Valdez-Scantling, they're perilously thin at wide receiver in the short and the long term behind their star wideout. Devontae Adams just turned 28. He's coming off of a season where he was arguably, Pablo, the best wide receiver in football on a snap-by-snap basis. This should be simple. But it's being complicated by a contract another team handed out to another wide receiver, the Cardinals. Had little leverage with DeAndre Hopkins, their new star addition, and so they negotiated a two-year, $54.5 million extension with Hopkins last year. That money's different from a typical contract because it doesn't really kick in until 2023. Adams' deal would start next season. And when you look at deals that are more similar to that in terms of the time frame, the top of the wide receiver market isn't more than $27 million a year like Hopkins. It's closer to $20 million a year, which is where Amari Cooper and Keenan Allen reside. So it's entirely possible that negotiations broke down last week because the Packers were negotiating off of Allen and Cooper's numbers, and Adams' camp was negotiating off of Hopkins' number. Here's where Rodgers renegotiating, though, helps the situation. The Packers can clear as much as $11.8 million in 2021 cap space by restructuring Rodgers' deal, which is seemingly going to happen in the days to come. Creating that cap space gives the Packers more flexibility as they try to extend their star wideout, who's going to have to be the building block for this team once Jordan Love is the quarterback in 2022.
So in terms of resetting a franchise's grand plan, Bill, I do want to pivot here to what's happening with Deshaun Watson, because I'm thinking back to March of this year, which feels like it was 100 years ago now, but that's when we first heard about the first of what would be, in the end, 22 civil lawsuits filed against the Texans quarterback. And today, news emerged that 10 women total have filed complaints about Watson to the Houston Police Department, and two of those 10 are not currently filing a civil lawsuit against Watson. But in the midst of all of these incredibly disturbing allegations, Watson has reported to training camp in Houston this week. So what exactly is happening there?
Not much. I mean, this whole thing sort of seems stuck in limbo. Watson doesn't want to play for the Texans very clearly, but he also doesn't want to get fined $50,000 per day for not reporting to camp. So he has to show up despite having no interest in realistically playing for this team. Reports on Monday suggested the Texans are ready to face the facts and trade away their star quarterback, but they can't really deal Watson while he's part of a significant lawsuit and both criminal and NFL investigations for sexual misconduct. The civil lawsuit is months away from completion, since Watson is not currently scheduled to sit for any deposition for that lawsuit until after the Super Bowl. ESPN's Chris Mortensen tweeted on Monday that Houston's price tag for Watson is realistic. Five significant assets, either high draft picks or starting caliber players. And it's difficult to imagine any team giving up that sort of bounty for even a talented quarterback like Watson while he's still being investigated for these allegations. What's curious about all of this, Pablo, is that there's a place for teams to put players while they're under these sorts of investigations. It's called the Commissioner's Exempt List. Adrian Peterson spent 2014 on this list while the league was investigating his child abuse case. Greg Hardy also spent that year on the commissioner's exempt list. The NFL hasn't placed Watson on that list yet, in part because he hasn't actually been charged in a criminal case. Watson's lawyer, Rusty Hardin, said in June that the NFL wouldn't act until the criminal investigation into the alleged assault was completed. The league would undoubtedly love for the police investigation to Watson to finish before the season so they could make a decision about him going on the exempt list, but this appears to be a situation where everybody involved is just waiting for something else to happen.
And so just to keep the football end of things in order here, Bill, who would be the quarterback for the Houston Texans if not Deshaun Watson?
If you're a Texans fan, you may want to sim to the end of the season for the 2021 campaign. The expected week one starter for the Houston Texans is Tyrod Taylor, a guy who looked pretty good in Buffalo, but he's completed just 51.2% of his passes since leaving the Bills after 2017. Behind Taylor is veteran Jeff Driscoll, who has gone 1-8 as a starter with the Bengals, Lions, and Broncos. Behind him, the younger option is third-rounder Davis Mills, who threw just 438 passes during his time at Stanford. Pablo, there are already sports books around the country taking bets on whether the Texans will finish 0-17.
Oh, gosh. Somewhere Jeff Driscoll is like very thankful that he just got referred to as a veteran. Like, that's a pretty big win for the Jeff Driscoll LinkedIn page at this point, if that's how we're characterizing him. But I want to head now to another part of the state of Texas, because in Dallas, Bill, where Dak Prescott is, he is back after missing most of the 2020 season due to that gruesome ankle injury that we all watched happen live on television. So how is his recovery going? What's the mood around the Cowboys as camp is opening up?
I have good news. Like, everything seems pretty good for the Cowboys. Like, maybe not good news if you're not a Cowboys fan, but I mean, they had five significant injured offensive starters last year in Dak Prescott, their tight end Blake Jarwin, and then three-star offensive linemen in Tyron Smith, Lyle Collins, and Zach Martin. All five of those guys did not need to go on the physically unable to perform list to start training camp. So it looks like they're going to be ready to go when padded practices start later this week. Of course, it's the Cowboys. Nothing can ever go truly perfectly right. So wideout Amari Cooper is on the physically unable to perform list after undergoing ankle surgery this offseason. Granted, if there's any position the Cowboys can afford an injury, it's wide receiver. So Dallas should be able to field something like their ideal offense as camp starts.
All right, so their offense is looking close to ideal, but after the break, Bill, I want to get to the controversy that is still swirling around Dallas and the rest of the league for that matter when it comes to the vaccine.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
What Dallas has been fielding is all sorts of questions about COVID protocols and vaccination, Bill, because Dak has been out there behind a podium talking about how he doesn't want to disclose his vaccine status. He cites HIPAA erroneously.
Have you gotten the vaccine?
I don't necessarily think that's exactly important, Clarence. I think that's HIPAA. But I understand where Zeke comes from. I understand everybody's opinion. And I think everybody's has that right.
But with this policy in the NFL that is new legislation around this, incentivizing players to get vaccinated in a way that seems to be pretty serious and legitimate, how do you think this plays out inside a locker room ecosystem?
So when you ask NFL players about what they're willing to tolerate from teammates in terms of their personalities, you get a pretty universal response, which is, can he play? If you're going to help the team win, or if you're a star player, bad opinions about politics or even toxic behavior doesn't do as much to hurt your standing as it does for a replacement-level player. I mean, the most perfect example of this are, in fact, the Dallas Cowboys, Pablo, because remember, at one time, Michael Irvin allegedly once stabbed his teammate in the neck with a pair of scissors because the legendary wideout thought he should get a haircut first, which is bad. Don't do that if you're an NFL player. What should tell you how this was being treated is that Cowboys coach Chan Gailey subsequently described the incident to the media as quote-unquote horseplay. If I get stabbed in the neck recording ESPN Daily, I am not going to let ESPN PR report it as horseplay, Pablo.
And if they do, we really need to change our opinions of the treatment of horses.
That's true. I feel bad for these horses just getting stabbed in the neck all the time. However, the gap between vaccinated and unvaccinated players has the potential to be more divisive than something like a political opinion because of how the league is structuring their rules this upcoming season. Players who aren't vaccinated will be forced to get tested every day, stay socially distant within their facility, travel separately from the vaccinated members of the team in a separate plane, and won't be allowed to leave the team hotel on road trips. Unvaccinated players will have limits on how they can use the team's weight room, steam room, and sauna. They'll also be subject to quarantine if they have contact with positive cases. And of course, Pablo, the impact of these measures will naturally hit marginal players the hardest. Take veteran free agent receiver Terrell Pryor, who said he had a tryout lined up this past weekend, only for the team to tell the former quarterback they would only let him in the building if he was vaccinated. The NFL's player pool, as much as we think about players like Dak Prescott and superstars of that caliber, the player pool mostly consists of players who are either free agents or guys who are desperately clinging on to a job. And those guys are going to have little choice but to get vaccinated. Players at the top of the pyramid, like Prescott, they won't feel that same sort of pressure.
So you outlined a bunch of the rule changes, and I want to get to the biggest picture ones. Because the NFL has been saying to clubs, if a game is postponed due to a COVID outbreak among unvaccinated players in specific, and that game cannot be rescheduled during the 18-week season in 2021, the team with the outbreak will forfeit the game, you'll get a loss, it'll count against the playoff seeding. All that real standings-based stuff is a concern. And so the scheduling stuff, given the turbulence of last season, what do you think this one's going to look like?
I have to be honest. I don't think the NFL is implementing this or announcing this hoping that they're going to have to do this, that they're going to have to fine players a full game check or cause some team to forfeit and lose a game because they weren't able to play. I think this is the worst case scenario as opposed to something they're actually planning on implementing during the regular season. But all last year, if you remember, we talked about the NFL maybe needing to add an extra week in the regular season just to kind of fill in those games that weren't able to be played during the regular season. At the end of the day, it didn't happen. But it's clear the NFL wanted to avoid that at all costs then and wants to avoid it now. I still think we'll see the league move games around, especially early in the season, while teams still have bye weeks to work with. But the possibility of this forfeit scenario is going to hang over teams' heads all year. Now, I don't think that's going to cause individual players who weren't going to get vaccinated to get vaccinated, but I do think it's going to push coaches and NFL executives to strongly encourage players to do so.
So some of those individual players who voiced opposition on the record to getting the vaccine, some of them we've already mentioned in this pod. DeAndre Hopkins is one of them. Cole Beasley is kind of the poster child at this point for this. Dak Prescott has been lumped into this group too. So how do you think this story evolves over the year from the player perspective? Because it does feel, Bill, like even if you avoid the worst case scenario, a new hierarchy of sorts is in place.
Absolutely. I mean, I think players are going to stop arguing about the vaccine on Twitter once the season gets started. But I do think this is going to continue to be a big story. Players, as we mentioned, are going to be strongly incentivized by the league's protocols to get the shot. And since their teams won't want them weakened by the effects of the vaccine during the season, I think you're going to see that pressure from teams start now during training camp. Outside of the top 1 to 2% of guys, unvaccinated NFL players are going to feel like second-class citizens in their own buildings. I mean, on Monday, there were reports the NFL is already allowing teams to have unvaccinated players wear colored armbands to differentiate themselves from the rest of their vaccinated teammates. That's not going to convince everybody to get a shot, but players who don't hold strong opinions about the vaccine are going to be given every reason to get one. And as the season goes on, this topic's not going to go away. Any team that gets off to a disappointing start or has an underwhelming season altogether is going to be evaluated for their vaccination rates. The players who didn't get the shot will be criticized and blamed for what went wrong, at least publicly, regardless of whether it actually had any effect on their season. Because Pablo, if I'm being honest with you, the NFL does not typically inspire very sophisticated or informed analysis of what went wrong for a team or a star player.
How dare you suggest as much?
Again, to go back to the Cowboys, Tony Romo lost fans in Dallas because he went on vacation to Cabo during a bye week before a playoff loss, a week where he was off. He went to dare to go to Cabo with Jessica Simpson, which is such a 2008.
And a more innocent time, that I missed.
Yes. So every single Cowboys loss in 2021 is going to be blamed on Dak Prescott's vaccination status, regardless of whether it actually has anything to do with whether they won or lost the game. Teammates feel like there's a missing element of cohesion because of the gap between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated. That could become an internal issue. I mean, we're already seeing Bills players discussing the pros and cons of the vaccine on Twitter, which is a very 2021 thing to say.
Yeah, Bill, I was already sort of praising Roger Goodell for having a strategy that leveraged locker room peer pressure, wins and losses, that sort of stuff to get players to get vaccinated, because clearly like medical self-interest and science wasn't doing the job. But now I realize that actually the real genius here is that the takes are going to flow.
Vaccines are not new in America. Are these same people who don't want to have this particular vaccine, or did they object to polio, the vaccine for polio?
Like sports takes, that tide turned against unvaccinated players. I can see that being quite potent, honestly.
And you know what? If the NFL wants to enforce it and the people want to get angry and people want to leave their jobs and leave their careers, then get out.
And the Bills locker room as a whole, they've been the target more than any other so far. And this is where I do want to be fair to them, because they're not actually at the bottom of the league in terms of vaccination rates, right?
You're right. According to the Associated Press, at least, the Colts and the Washington football team are the two organizations in the NFL who don't even have half of their players vaccinated. On the other hand, 10 teams have more than 85% of their players vaccinated, and about 73% of the players on NFL rosters are vaccinated. That number should rise as teams work their way through training camp, and because of the NFL's rules, the vast majority of coaches and front office executives are already fully vaccinated, but that doesn't preclude them from getting COVID. As you may have heard, on Monday, the Colts, who we just mentioned as one of the teams who have not had more than half of their players vaccinated, their head coach, Frank Reich, who is fully vaccinated, tested positive for COVID and is currently quarantining. So there is still going to be some risk here for coaches and executives around teams whose players are not fully vaccinated.
And Bill, on top of that, in terms of the organizational stuff, we've already seen two coaches basically lose their jobs on account of refusing to get vaccinated. I mean, Vikings assistant and offensive line coach Rick Dennison, and then Pat's co-offensive line coach Cole Popovich. Dennison has been formally dismissed from that job. Popovich won't be with the team this season, which seems to indicate that when it comes to coaching and the staff of a team, these franchises really are not messing around.
Yeah, it's absolutely true that the rules are different for coaches and basically will continue to be different for coaches until the foreseeable future. I mean, assistant coaches who refuse the vaccine and don't have either a medical or a religious exemption won't have what the NFL calls tier one status within the organization. What that means in reality is that coaches who aren't vaccinated won't be able to interact with players in person, enter the team's facility, or be on the field for games, which are pretty important parts of being an NFL coach. A team could theoretically retain a coach who doesn't want to abide by those rules, but in the NFL in 2021, if you're a coach, not getting the vaccine amounts to giving up your livelihood at this level.
So, Bill, as we prepare to get back into regular season football mode, even though it's still July, I know we've covered like every bit of the emotional football spectrum. We've been whimsical. We've been very serious. I'm curious, what is the story that you think is flying beneath the radar that we haven't touched on here yet?
Okay, the story that has flown below the radar is that our colleague Stephen A. Smith suggested that HBO rename Hard Knocks for the Cowboys to Soft Knocks. And as a country, we failed by not storming the court N1 style to signal the end of the take game, because we're not going to top that.
Bill, I just recall something Stephen A. said, which had, I think, previously been the gold medalist in that category, when he once said, "Gangrene. The Jets are so bad, that's an insult to gangs."
Give that man a Super Bowl ring, if you ask me.
Bill Barnwell, an owner of his own unique, and I am sure, incredibly, blindingly beautiful ring. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you, Papa.
Okay, coming up, we catch up with a colleague who once competed in meets against Katie Ledecky, the swimmer who just happens to be on track to become the most decorated female Olympian of all time.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So we've reached the point in the Tokyo Games where everyone's eyes are turning toward the pool, because swimming is on, and for SportsCenter's own Ashley Brewer, that is personal. So Ashley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so cool. I listen to you all the time, so to be on, I am so pumped.
Well, I watch you all the time because you are now a SportsCenter anchor, but I summoned you here to talk to you about your former life, before all this, before all the television, because you, Ashley, were a competitive swimmer for Texas and then for USC, both swimming powerhouses. So the Summer Olympics for you. What is it like when this whole thing is happening? Because I know you once competed in the Olympic trials, like back in 2012, right?
Yeah, I did. That was in Omaha. So much fun. And it feels like a different Ashley Brewer. It does not feel like the woman that I am today. I'm 29, so it's been a little bit. But swimming for so long was everything to me. It was, you know, wake up, swim, school, swim. Like, it was my whole life. And then just really just 1 or 2 weeks out of, you know, 4 years, everyone's like all in on swimming.
Yeah. And so now it is time to talk about Katie Ledecky, because going hand in hand with caring about swimming for a week or two out of the year is caring about the most dominant women swimmer we've ever seen, I think. I mean, she's 24 years old, Ashley. Her current career medal count at last check is 5 golds and 2 silvers. And look, she was the reigning gold medalist in the 400 meter free back in Rio, where she won by like nearly 5 seconds, but she lost this time to Ariane Titmus, and Katie got the silver in Tokyo. So you watched this. How big of an upset was this? How did this happen?
So it wasn't that much of an upset for, I think, those who paid close attention to what had been brewing over the last year or so, because actually last year in the 2019 World FINA Games, Titmus actually beat Katie Ledecky in the 400. And I think that's when everyone was like, whoa, do we actually for the first time have someone who can be a threat to Katie Ledecky? So for it to happen, of course, on this global stage of the Olympics was shocking to a lot of people. And I think it was shocking to Katie. But I just thought watching Titmus and the masterful race she put together, she was controlled the entire time. And one thing we call in swimming is when you build into it. And it was really that last 100 she built into, and then she was able to just take off. Katie Ledecky did not build into the race. She came out strong and was, you know, leading by body lengths at one point. And then all of a sudden, last 100, flip turn, and Titmus just took over, and Katie seemed like her legs were kind of dying. She was just trying to shovel to push water. And that's like the worst feeling ever as a swimmer, when you're literally just throwing your limbs all over the place, just praying that you're scooping water. And it just looked, honestly, it looked painful for Katie, someone who usually swims so smoothly and powerfully. Titmus just had the control all the way to the very end.
Yeah, I mean, someone else who had a certain build through this race, who built into their celebration, it felt like, was Ariane's coach.
Yes!
Ashley. I mean, he reacted like an audience member on Oprah who had just, like, been given a house.
He is going crazy. Oh, my goodness. He's, like, putting on a show like Mick Jagger or the Rolling Stones or something.
I don't know if that was something that is common in swimming. How did you react to his reaction?
I was all about it. I loved it so much. And my first thought was like, dang, I wish I had that kind of hype man in my life. Dude was losing his mind. I don't know, Pablo, if you saw this, but in the background, I think it was one of the Olympic handlers, or maybe it was the security. She had no idea what to do.
Oh, she was reacting like, I think, a normal human being who was not familiar at all with how swimming celebrates.
But no, it's actually pretty typical, I think, to see, especially on like a distance free race, you hear a lot of the coaches, and if you go to a meet, it's the most annoying thing in the world, but you hear coaches making these weird, like, kind of noises. Swim coaches in a way are a little kind of different. So for him to celebrate and lose his mind and probably be screaming, and who even knows what was coming out of his mouth, it was just, I was like, yep, that's like a distance swim coach. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think I can still hear him screaming in the distance right now, actually. But we're going to look ahead here, Ashley, because Katie Ledecky is far from over. I mean, we just finished watching her in heats as we're taping this here together on Monday. How did she look to you?
Katie looks strong and controlled. And so I was worried after watching the 400 that she was just tired. Like, did she not come in as rested and as fresh as she had hoped? And that's what you kind of saw 400 when she died there at the end. It's like, uh-oh, like, you know, is that a sign of what's to come in all the other races? So before leading into this Olympics, in the 800 freestyle, she had the 24 fastest swims ever of all time. The 1500, which is the mile, which I'm so pumped they put in the Olympics, by the way, she had the top 11 times ever swum. to me, that 800 to mile is like Katie's money spot. She knows how to control those races. And I think that's when we're going to see like dominant Katie Ledecky again when she swims the final. I'm so pumped for her. She's so fun to watch. And I'm glad that people appreciate what she's doing. I'll never forget the first time I watched her actually swim the mile. I want to say I was like maybe 18 years old and we were in the same swim meet down in Southern California. And like, there was no one even like 100 within her. Like she was like lapping girls and she broke the world record that day. And I remember it was this period of time where she just kept like breaking and breaking and breaking. And every time she'd go a best time, she'd just keep like upping the record.
Ashley, it sounds like you watch Katie Ledecky, despite all of your expertise, kind of in a similar way to a lot of the people who are just discovering her, which is to say, this person, even to those who know the sport as well as anybody, this person kind of feels like an alien.
Yes, exactly. Like we're all witnessing greatness together. Like we look at Michael Jordan or LeBron James and look at her and say, this is special. And we might not see any other swimmer like this again in our lifetime. No one can do what Katie Ledecky's doing. Even Titmuss, she might be great at the 200, 400, but no way Titmuss could come close to her in a mile or even really an 800. So yeah, no, I think we are all just witnessing the greatness that is Katie Ledecky. And I think her records will stand for a long time and prove how great she truly is.
Ashley Brewer, our swimming correspondent now, thank you for loading ESPN Daily onto your schedule today.
If you ever need anything on the swimming front, I got you.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.